Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned into The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics, government, and selfishness went wrong, and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of insight, aimed at making each of us more responsible, more cooperative, and more aware of the spiritual bonds that connect us to each other, no matter what we find to squabble over. You can call us toll-free from the U.S. to 877-876-5227. You can call from Canada to 888-810-8322. Or you can call direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. Find out if one of those old-fashioned on-the-air stations in your area carries this show. Just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as soon as it is humanly possible on the station archives. Now, my own blog is titled How the Neocons Stole Freedom, and is conveniently located at howtheneoconsstolefreedom.blogspot.com. My blog this week is on various sundry things, and I suggest that you check it out for your elucidation and my delight. Now, here at the Spiritual Politician, we continue to connect the dots so that you can see the whole picture and understand how that nasty alliance of government and corporations are working to convert America into a corporate plantation. Now, last week, our guest was Mikey Weinstein, the author of With God on Our Side, and he talked about his war against the evangelical coup in America's military. I hope all of you went out and got the book. There was a lot there that needed saying. This week, our guest will be connecting more of those dots in that same arena and filling out the pieces of the puzzle that appear on connectallthedots.blogspot.com. So check that out. And now, from the week just passed, this week our correspondent in Baghdad, Jane Stillwater, narrowly missed a suicide attack aimed at Parliament. She was in the hospital reporting on another story when victims began arriving with blood on their faces. Catch her reports on the Iconoclast site at lonestaricon.com. Jane will be coming out to Kuwait on her way home this evening, so you can expect to hear her here soon. I know that the line she writes will continue to build the big picture. And now our thoughts for the week ahead. Happy birthday, Thomas Jefferson. Today is the 264th anniversary of the birth of Thomas Jefferson, the author of the Declaration of Independence. And here are a few facts about Jefferson for us to remember today. In the thick of party conflict in 1800, Thomas Jefferson wrote in a private letter, "I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility to every form of tyranny over the mind of man." And that's a sentiment and pledge each of us should mull over now. This powerful advocate of liberty was born in 1743 in Albemarle County, Virginia, inheriting from his father, a planter and surveyor, some 5,000 acres of land, and from his mother, a Randolph, high social standing. He studied at the College of William and Mary and then read law. In 1772, he married Martha Way Skelton, a widow, and took her to live in his partially constructed mountaintop home, Monticello. Freckled and sandy-haired and rather tall and awkward, Jefferson was eloquent as a correspondent, but he was no public speaker. In the Virginia House of Burgesses and the Continental Congress, he contributed his pen rather than his voice to the patriot cause. As a silent member of the Congress, Jefferson, at 33, drafted the Declaration of Independence. In years following, he labored to make its words a reality in Virginia. Most notably, he wrote a bill establishing religious freedom, enacted in 1786. Religious freedom is one of the foundations on which America stands. That means all of us, however we experience that ineffable presence that connects us to the unseeable presence that is always there, when and if we choose to open ourselves to understanding. However you experience your relationship with that ineffable is true for you. Buddhist, Muslim, Wiccan, Jew, Christian, or atheist, it's up for you to fill in the blank. Each of us confronts ourselves, drawn to understand and to love if we listen. Celebrate Thomas Jefferson and the vision that remains to be fulfilled for an America where all humanity are one, no exceptions and no lies. Now, I have a confession. I can't sing, but I'm going to read you a song I've always loved about Jefferson. It was written by a man born on a ship coming to the United States from Palestine in 1948. His mother and her entire family were forced off the land they had owned for 400 years. Dean Ahmad became a complete American. He took his Ph.D. in astrophysics and went on to start the Minaret of Freedom in Washington, D.C., dedicated to helping Muslims understand what freedom means. And he wrote this song in Thomas Jefferson's birthday, 1976. In colonial Virginia lived 200 years ago. The land was green and wild then, and men were free to grow. Philosopher, inventor, naturalist, and diplomat. A lover of the common folk, unlikely aristocrat. I'm proud of all your words and deeds in the freedom fight you won. And I'm proud to be a child of yours, Thomas Jefferson. In 1776, Americans were held down. Their natural rights had been usurped by the despot British crown. They declared independence in a paragraph and asked if you would polish it. When government destroys our rights, you said we must abolish it. Right on, death to tyrants, everyone. They pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their honors, everyone. They were men to match your mighty phrases, Thomas Jefferson. You wrote that all men born possess inherent liberty, for human rights are not a gift or the whim of society. But how they lie about you, how they twist the life you led, like the reason that you freed your slaves from your dying bed. Did you see the unbound future of the nation you'd begun? Did you dream of universal freedom, Thomas Jefferson? The men we now call heroes that you knew as living men, Patrick Henry with his mighty voice and Tom Paine with his pen, George Mason with his Bill of Rights, he knew there were more than 10. It's a tragedy America won't see those men again. But it's not too late to save a world with tyrants overrun. For you have many sons and daughters, Thomas Jefferson. Happy birthday, Thomas. Now, our guest tonight is Dr. Bruce Prescott. Dr. Prescott is a minister for Norman, Oklahoma, who presently is on the board for an organization called, appropriately enough, the Separation of Church and State. He and others have grown increasingly troubled in recent years by the spiritual direction of those we now think of as the theocons. He's here today to tell us about the response to where the theology of control has taken us, its logical destination, and what each of us can do to change direction. Please welcome Bruce Prescott.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, it's my pleasure. I'm so glad that you could be with us today. And we always start the program by asking our guests to tell us a little bit something about themselves personally that they don't know yet. So tell us a little about yourself.
Well, you introduced me as a Baptist minister. I went to a Southern Baptist seminary, and for a time I taught philosophy at Tarrant County Junior College. I was a pastor in Houston. Now I work for an organization called Mainstream Oklahoma Baptists, which is part of a network of moderate kind of progressive mainstream Baptists across the country that are actually disgusted with the takeover, fundamentalist takeover of the Southern Baptist Convention. So we spend most of our time trying to inform Baptist lay people about what has happened to their denomination and the kind of leadership that they have now, which is working hand in glove with the new right, the religious right, and these theocons that you've asked me on to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. And tell us what it's like. I mean, you're in Norman, Oklahoma. That's sort of, I wouldn't say it's you know, the buckle of the Bible Belt, but there's
it's
certainly
close.
A lot of that going on there.
Yeah. But Oklahoma is a very religious state. It's the major predominant denomination of Christians within the state are Baptists. And most of those are Southern Baptists. You'd expect probably about 20% of the population in the state are 20% is Baptist. And it's a very conservative state, very religious, very conservative, very supportive of the current administration, though that support has even shifted here in this state. It used to be much stronger than it is now.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us a little bit about that. So they're starting to waver in terms of their support of Bush?
Well, I think what's opened a lot of people's eyes, if, you know, people are, they give the president and the administration and the people that lead our country the benefit of a doubt, particularly when they're talking about matters of national defense and security. And they assumed that what they were saying about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq were legitimate, that the intelligence had not been fixed. And the more that revelations come out about that and other kinds of scandals that are involving the administration, slowly but surely, even those that have been the most strong supporters of the current administration are beginning to question what's going on. I don't think, you know, the newspapers here have not really reported a lot of the news that you can get in other places. If you're on the internet, you'll know a lot more than you ever would if you picked a newspaper up or watched the TV news in Oklahoma. But there's been enough that has filtered through that people are puzzled and mystified, and the support is on the decline.
Mm-hmm. Well, things are trickling through, but it certainly takes a long time.
Yeah.
For that to happen, which of course is one of the problems and one of the things that they rely on. And that goes to the fact that, you know, so much of the media is simply owned by the corporations now.
Well, that's one of the reasons why the work that you're doing here on the internet is so exciting. What we're doing is finding a way around all those gatekeepers that try to filter information and give a spin on the information. You get it unfiltered, and you get various spins on the internet that you could never get through the mainstream media.
And well, and a lot of people actually get all of their news there, and they get a lot of their news from places like the Iconoclast in Texas, and then also from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes the Iconoclast actually breaks stories that then get filtered into Europe.
Yeah.
But you're sort of living in a place that, you know, it's almost like a different kind of reality. Than the coast.
Yeah, I came here deliberately. I was in Houston, Texas, which, though Texas is a conservative state and Houston a conservative city, there's a whole lot more cosmopolitan atmosphere in Houston, Texas than there is in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, or Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is the largest cities that are here.
Mm-hmm.
But I came here deliberately. I came here deliberately because this was the center for the takeover of the Southern Baptist Convention. Now, there were, you know, there's a movement that was all across the United States, but when you look at the leadership of the Southern Baptist Convention during the takeover years, you're going to find that more of those that were president of the Southern Baptist Convention have had contact, either been the pastor or been very influential in one Southern Baptist church in Del City, Oklahoma. So,
really? What would you say the beginning year of the takeover is?
It's 1979.
In
Baptist circles, that's a very famous year because that was the year that the takeover began. It was over with by 1990, and literally every single position on every board, every agency, and every institution of the Southern Baptist Convention is appointee from a fundamentalist, very hardcore conservative fundamentalist president. Now, initially, what they were doing was, they said it was a theological battle that was involved in the Southern Baptist Convention to purge the Southern Baptist Convention of liberals, But actually, what it was from the very beginning has been a political movement, and you find right now probably the most influential, or one of the most influential leaders in contact on a weekly basis with this particular administration is Richard Land, who is the head of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. Nothing really strongly ethical, and hardly any religious liberty coming out of that commission today.
Mm-hmm.
But he's in the forefront. I read an article not long ago that asked whether he was going to be the replacement for James Dobson and the influence in evangelicals in America.
Well, that's a scary thought.
Well, he's being groomed for that. Alberto Gonzalez, the Attorney General of the United States, deputized him and all Southern Baptists just a few weeks ago to help him as freedom fighters. Catch that, freedom fighters for the First Amendment. So,
the First Amendment?
That's right. This, their job
is
to help him.
Is his burst into flame?
Well, these are people that follow W.A. Criswell, who said that separation of church and state was a figment of some infidel's imagination. So you can see what kind of freedom fighters that we're going to have.
Well, yes, they're going to fight freedom every place they find it.
Well, it's freedom for them, and as it was in the Southern Baptist Convention, the way they define freedom is you're free to agree or you're free to leave. And I suspect there will be a lot of reverse immigration once these guys have their way. If they do, hopefully we'll see a reversal of some of this movement toward theocracy, minimum of Christian nationalism that these people support. And that's really kind of what this program's about, the theocons. What is their goal for America? What is their plan and what is their design? And the theocons are really, in one form or another, trying to find some way to assert the supremacy of the Christian faith and the Christian religion. Now, that's never been what our country, from the Constitution, from the very beginning, the First Amendment of the Constitution is there because Baptists, of all people, refused to adopt a Constitution and ratify a Constitution that did not have explicit guarantees for religious liberty. Back in those days, they were the persecuted minority. They were the ones that were being thrown in jail because they didn't preach and didn't have licenses from the approved established churches. And they never wanted that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But now the Baptists are majority, at least the majority of the Protestants in the United States, and they've teamed together with the conservative, neoconservative Catholic theocons, and then working together with the Jewish neoconservatives, and that alliance has proven to be very strong over the last 20, 25 years as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all converging on removing the First Amendment, or reinterpreting it. Let's say they're not going to strike it. They're not going to have some kind of a movement across the United States where we're going to repeal the First Amendment. We're just going to say the First Amendment has been interpreted wrong all these years, and we have to interpret it so that Christianity is the established religion and the other religions can be tolerated on a second-class basis. And that's what you see working out of the Bush White House.
Well, that's a very interesting take on it, of course, especially since Bush happens to be a Methodist, supposedly.
Well, yeah, but he's not really following the direction of Methodist bishops, particularly about the war, no more than the theocon Catholics take the direction of the Pope in regard to the war. They've got an agenda and a plan that they're working out, and they use religion more than anything else to further their political purposes, and that's part of, I think, the influence of Leo Strauss that's been on the neoconservative movement. Leo
mm-hmm.
Strauss was a Jewish scholar that fled Nazi Germany, came to the United States, and spent some time teaching political historian. But he's been exceedingly very influential on people like Paul Wolfowitz, who's in the news today because the World
yes.
Bank is trying to figure out if they're going to fire him.
Well, one can hope, of course, that they do.
Well, it seems that the last I heard of an NPR was that the president still supports him, but I think the World Bank has got their own board that makes that decision, not the President of the United States, I hope.
Well, yes, and we're going to see what happens there. Now, It's very interesting that if you go back in time and see when the Theocon movement started, I've never seen any evidence it was actually a religious movement. It looks to me like it was entirely based in politics.
Well, there's religion that's been part of it. The key leaders, when I distinguish between the neoconservatives, when I talk about those, I prefer to talk about Jewish neoconservatives because Leo Strauss and most of the key players that you see, the key intellectuals, particularly then the related to the war and things like that, have been Jewish. But a lot of the support also, they work hand in glove with Catholic neoconservatives, the Catholic Theocons. There's a really good book by Damon Linker out, a brand new book out in the last few months called The Theocon, Secular America Under Siege. And Damon Linker used to be the editor for the major Theocon journal in America, First Things magazine. So he's given you the inside scoop on these particular people. But the key leaders of that movement in an organization that was founded in 1981, the Institute for Religion and Democracy.
Yeah.
They also have a think tank called Institute for Religion and Public Life. These people, Richard John Neuhaus, who converted from being a Lutheran to becoming a Catholic, and he's the key author of, you know, The Naked Public Square. I mean, this is the kind of key work for this particular Theocon movement. They're saying that what's happened is that religion has been pushed out of the public square, and they're going to fight back. I mean, that's the battle that's been going on now for more than 30 years. Of course, I tell people here in Oklahoma when they say that, I say, no, that's not right. Well, what's happened is the public square in Oklahoma has been taken over by these theocrats, and they have pushed everybody that's not an evangelical Christian off to a corner or pushed them completely out. But they keep complaining about the naked public square. Another one of their key leaders is Michael Novak. Now, you'll see him on TV all the time. He does a lot of work on economics.
Is he related to Robert?
To Robert Novak, I don't believe so. If there is a link, I don't know that. Michael Novak...
It would be interesting to find out, though.
Yeah, it would be. Michael Novak bills himself as a theologian. And mostly what he writes in his theology is kind of a, he's a cheerleader for capitalism and democracy, and understood from a kind of a Catholic perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And then a third one is George Weigel, who is probably most famous as a biographer of Pope John Paul II. And those three people are the key leaders of the Institute for Religion and Democracy, which also has an organization that's divisions within their organization that are focused on mainline Protestant. Catch this, the leaders are all Roman Catholics, but they're working on mainline Protestant denominations, the National Council of Churches, the World Council of Churches. How they initially got involved was trying to find a way to influence them, and now they're working on renewal movements is what they call them. Takeover movements is what I would call them. They resemble and are modeling themselves after the takeover of the Southern Baptist Convention. But these renewal movements are working to create divisions and put conservatives in control of the Methodist Church, the Presbyterian Church, the Episcopal Church, and United Church of Christ. And every time that you'll see any kind of division, particularly as it relates to the gay and lesbian issues, they will always have the Institute of Religion and Democracy behind pushing, trying to find a way to preserve the conservative theology of mainline Protestant denominations. It's amazing. But they have entire organizations working on those things all across the country. Some of these denominations are waking up to that.
Well, yes, you would eventually. If you saw it happen to the guy next door, you would be warned.
Well, you know, it's been under the radar screen. They haven't actually publicized it well, but there's a couple of really good books that have been published about this. It's astonishing how much they are alike, even though they're dealing with different denominations. There's a book by Leon Howell called United Methodism at Risk, and the at is like an at for the Internet. was published in 2003, and there was another one that was published in the year 2000 by Lewis Daly called A Moment to Decide, The Crisis in Mainstream Presbyterianism. And here in Oklahoma, there's a group that's calling themselves Mainstream Methodists. I'm a Mainstream Baptist. They've kind of picked this up. They're fighting this influence of these renewal movements that are trying to find a way to take over the Methodist denomination here in Oklahoma. So this is something that is starting, some of the people are starting to wake up and realize. But
have you
been
gotten
going
together yet with other denominations working on the same thing?
Well, I talk with those people, kind of give them some advice. One of the things that is different, though, is the different polity, the different ways that churches are governed. You know, in a Baptist church, Baptists are kind of pure Democrats. We may elect messengers. We don't even elect delegates. We elect what we call a messenger who goes and votes his convictions. He's not supposed to go and vote a certain way to a convention, and then you take a vote of those that are there, and it's a purely democratic kind of process. There are different ways that each denomination handles its governance, but in whatever way they handle their governance, these takeover movements are trying to find a way to work through those systems to, in effect, destroy them, find a way to take them over and put them into the service of this vast theoconservative movement.
Vast theoconspiracy?
Well, I would say that when you can see that the same organization's got all these different divisions within its own building and its own organization working on that, it's not hard to recognize there's some kind of a conspiracy there.
Well, yes. I don't disagree that there's a conspiracy. I think there is.
Well, some people
I think it's a pretty open conspiracy in a lot of ways, because now so many people see what the neocons are about and how they did what they did.
Well,
because they use exactly the same playbook, so to speak.
Yeah, there's a lot of overlap between that. There's a lot of cross-fertilization, but you know, one of their main tactics, I know some of the people, if you look at the Talk to Action website, you'll see a lot of information about the Institute of Religion and Democracy, and some of those key people, particularly that are coming out of the Methodist circles and trying to expose this, talk about they're continually challenged for people saying, well, give us some proof, more than, you know, all these parallel things happening in different churches at the same time. So, you know, while some of this is happening out in the open, it's not open enough for those that want to pretend that it's not there.
Yeah, so the way I've always handled that is I just make fun of them. Because people then tell you, they sort of get the message. It's harder to fight back when it's humor.
Well, those things are helpful in times and places when you can get theirs.
But I know it probably doesn't work where you are because you have, you know, because of the sense of humor issue.
Well, sometimes humor goes over people's heads, though. You know, it's ironic, and sometimes people think you're serious. So
I've had that happen to me, too.
Yeah,
so tell us more about what happened. I mean, you saw this rise just exactly where you are, ground zero for the theocracy, you know, in the Baptist religion. What did you, when you saw this starting to happen, and you picked it, how long have you been where you are?
I've been here for about almost 9 years. In the fall, it'll be 9 years that I've been in Oklahoma. The work that I'm doing, I've been doing ever since I left seminary, when the takeover was still in progress. So that will go back to the late 80s. But I did it in Houston, Texas, and was part of a movement that was successful in that state. You know, the Texas Baptist Convention at the state level is not dominated by fundamentalists, nor is the one in Virginia, which is where a very strong part of the Southern Baptist kind of population lives. But Oklahoma was already taken over when I came here. I came here because this is the place where you need to find a way to explain to the lay people and others that are involved in these churches what these changes are, and find ways to communicate with them. It's the same way in the United States. I mean, if you're on the coasts, you guys are kind of, you got a group of people that think like you. You're not isolated. You're not alone. You've got a voice. But if you're in a place like Oklahoma, you've got to have some people that come and will stand up, and you're kind of a lonely voice crying in the wilderness, but hoping that someone out there is listening and starts putting the pieces together. Because if we can't change places like Oklahoma and Kansas and these other places where people are not familiar with what is going on and do not see what's happening, we're not going to be effective. We've got to move sentiment and increase understanding all across the country.
So how do you do that?
Well, I keep trying to find ways to do that myself. One way I do it is things like what you're doing it with a radio program that I broadcast once a week. Another way is over the Internet. I have a blog. I have a website, so I can try to find a way to communicate with people. And actually, people from around the world will come to the website and catch the blog. And they can catch podcasts and things like that. You use the new means of technology, which gives you a greater reach. When I first came here, there wasn't much except, you know, a website that you could put up. And it was kind of early days of even, you know, working on the web and newsletters. You mm-hmm. find the name of any Baptist that I can find, and I still do that. Any Baptist I can find in the state of Oklahoma, I send them a newsletter and try to help to explain to them what has happened. What is hard for people to comprehend is that someone would actually organize a movement, take over all of the institutions, redirect them in a political in another way.
Well, they don't see what the point would be, but of course they don't understand what was going on in the Republican Party at the time. They don't understand that nasty, ugly alliance between Rove and Reid and Robertson and Abramoff.
Well, but from the very beginning, it was national politics that was at stake here.
Mm-hmm.
The largest Protestant denomination in America are Southern Baptists. Now one of the chief spokesmen for evangelicals in the United States is in Washington, D.C., as the head of the Southern Baptists kind of political action committee. He's up there. He's on TV. He's on Colbert, I think, last night, they told me.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Colbert had Richard Lamb down there. What they've now got is a voice, but the voice they have is a different voice than we had before. And it's enlightening, I think, if you go back and see the people that they replaced. The people they replaced are the people that were working with Southern Baptists through the Civil Rights era to keep Southern Baptists from being an impediment to civil rights.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying Richard Land is part of that crew, because Richard Land has done some things to try to find a way to apologize for the history of racism that Southern Baptists have. The denomination started in 1845 on racist principles, but you know, he's managed to lead the denomination through those things. But they have a different battle that they're fighting. And if you'll think back, what was going on in 1979? What happened in the late 70s and the days when Jimmy Carter was president? They were working on the Equal Rights Amendment and Southern Baptists.
Well, they had to stop that.
You're right. You had an entire religious movement. The evangelical movement in America was fighting equal rights. And the first state, catch this, the first state that did not ratify the Equal Rights Amendment was Oklahoma.
Aha, ground zero for
ground zero for the culture wars.
That's absolutely right. And they actually identified a long time before you think of the other side, you know, identifying just how pivotal the Equal Rights Amendment was going to be. They very clearly understood that. That's why, of course, they unleashed Schlafly.
Well, she was instrumental, and she was part of that. But Schlafly was I think, probably at this point, not as effective as Tim LaHaye's wife, Beverly LaHaye, Concerned Women of America, or something like that. That organization started back in those days to fight equal rights, and was it's a stronger organization now than Phyllis Schlafly's.
Well, yes, she's aged, and she hasn't aged particularly well
In
a lot of ways. But at the time, she was the last word.
Yeah, she goes all the way back to Barry Goldwater days, if I'm not mistaken. She's been active and involved in conservative politics long before the Equal Rights Amendment was there.
Well, she was one of what you think of as, because you have to remember back then, the Equal Rights Amendment wasn't a right-left issue at all. The Republican Party supported the Equal Rights Amendment. Conservatives supported the Equal Rights Amendment.
Well, it's it's hard for me to
I know it's,
to
it's
go back
incredible.
That far and remember that.
In 1968, the environment wasn't a polarizing issue. It was something all Americans had come together on. And the first head of the EPA was actually Senator Howard Baker, and he was a conservative Republican from Tennessee.
Yeah, I wonder how conservative they would
think about it.
Yeah, I wonder how conservative they think Howard Baker is today.
Well, that's, you see, what they've done is they changed the terms.
Even Barry Goldwater.
Barry Goldwater was
too liberal for him.
He was, Barry Goldwater, in absolute terms, was, being a conservative means that you're cautious about change, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. You need to be cautious because you don't want to do something that's going to cause harm. But the issue there was taking over the term conservative, because these people aren't conservatives.
Actually, it's a very radical thing that they're trying to do. The only thing that would be conservative is if you were trying to go back to before the days of the American Revolution and you wanted to make, you know, King George the king again and have an established Anglican church, particularly on the church-state issues, because that was decided. If you're conserving the Constitution, then you would be involved with Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty, and those kinds of organizations which are now connected with, you know, the liberal branch of American public life.
And that's what they did. They very intentionally redefined exactly what the political landscape looked like, and every bit of it was very intentional.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think we've got hidden agendas and a lot of these organizations that are allied right now trying to find a way to make a headway, and I see some fractures that are taking place, but we still haven't seen, I think, the end of the right-wing movement. It's just kind of hit a lull at the moment.
Well, I think actually the Bush administration and the neocons have gone into meltdown, because what you're seeing in D.C. is that there are a lot of interviews going on. They're looking at they're looking for a new PR firm, and so to speak.
Yeah. Well, they're looking for a candidate that can unite them all. And right now, the evangelical wing is floundering. What you'll see is James Dobson, who thinks that Newt Gingrich is going to do it, and Richard Land is saying, "No, I don't trust Newt, but I like Fred Thompson." Then Mike Huckabee, who's a Southern Baptist but involved with the fundamentalist takeover of the Southern Baptist Convention, Mike Huckabee's thrown his hat in the ring. I don't think they think that he's got enough stature to try to make anything happen. But I think right now I think they're just completely at a loss to know who they can nominate that has an opportunity and a good chance of trying to unite them all.
Well, they can't. There's nobody out there that actually has that kind of standing, and they do everything they can to avoid Ron Paul. They don't even want him mentioned.
Well, yeah, Ron Paul is more of a libertarian, and he's libertarian on social issues where they're not.
Makes him very attractive. There's a whole movement going on the left now amongst left libertarians who are, you know, seriously looking at supporting Paul. Because, you know, at least he's never deviated in terms of his votes on things like the war and the Patriot Act. And they can't look at their own and find that.
Yeah. Well, we are in a unusual time, but I think the biggest thing that people need to realize is that this right-wing kind of evangelical theoconservative movement is not going to go away. They may only have one-third of the population, but they're involved politically. They are connected. Bush's administration has got more than 150 people who come from Pat Robertson's law school alone, sitting in positions. That's the second in command there for Alberto Gonzalez, who just retired, or just resigned, is one of them, because, so she didn't have to testify under oath. We've got a lot of these people that have now been in influential positions, if they're not already still in influential positions, and they're going to be around for a long time trying to find a way to influence public policy, and they've got the credentials now to do it. On top of the fact that the organizations that these people run, they put out their newsletters. They have their data banks where they call and get the vote out. They are not going to stop. They've been at this for 25 years. Every time somebody's counted them out, they come right back to life and come back stronger. Mm-hmm. What they're going to do is they're going to be a very strong opposition if someone's elected that's not acceptable to them.
Well, you're talking about sort of a Project Arkansas on steroids, maybe?
Well, yeah. You're going to find something along those lines, whatever they have to manufacture to keep their people in line and to try to cause some dissension.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to happen. And I think what we need to realize is that they have been working through the democratic processes. They did that in the churches. You know, this movement within the churches is working within the system in each church to take it over. They're organized. They have plotted a strategy. They are patient revolutionaries. They'll take what time it takes to make it happen. They did that in the Southern Baptist Convention. It happens there quicker than many other denominations, and they are doing that in the United States. So if they're just set back, it's a setback, but they're going to stay and work at it. Now, the opposition keeps thinking, well, everything's going to change. We get a little knockout here and put somebody in office, and you think what's going to happen is now everything's going to be fine. They've been counted out I can't tell how many different times.
Are you talking about local elections?
I'm talking about national elections.
Well, in 06, of course, there was a displacement, but everybody, I think a lot of people predicted exactly what's happened, that these people wouldn't do anything.
Well, they what's happened is they have a tough time trying to get some of these people out to the polls again. But the only way that you're going to beat them consistently is to organize and get people to the polls to vote. Now, they learned that in the Southern Baptist Convention. I'm part of the movement that was late realizing that you had to organize politically. You know, in Baptist life, we were all friends and relatives. I mean, we're all part of the same denomination. We're just trying to figure out how to organize together to do the Lord's work. We weren't political.
Well, no, but there was definitely a social justice agenda that was perfectly appropriate and part of the whole American, ideal.
Well, there was a social justice agenda that was going on nationally that we were trying to find a way not to get on the wrong side of. And that set these guys off until they got themselves organized to take over politically in the denomination. And they organized a political movement to do it. And when we counter-organized the political movement, the mainstream movement that I'm in, we are too late to save the denomination. And what you're looking at is an organized political movement in the United States that is going to need.
Mm-hmm.
I can hear whistles, but I don't know.
I don't know where they're coming from either. But it's very interesting. Somebody, maybe they don't like what we're saying, huh?
Probably not.
They probably don't. Tell me, you said that there were several people who took over the leadership positions within, within the Baptist movement, from your own area,
yeah,
and that they, they sort of cycled them through, which is the sort of thing that you see these people do.
Yeah, well, it's astonishing, and could be accidental, but it seems astonishing to me that what you'll see. One of the earliest ones that came out of Oklahoma was Bailey Smith. People remember him as the one that got up and said, God does not hear the prayer of a Jew. And then after Bailey Smith, you had Jimmy Draper. Jimmy Draper came out of that. He was a pastor of that church before Bailey Smith had been pastor of that church. And then
mm-hmm.
a little bit later on, you had Tom Ellis, who was the pastor of that church after Bailey Smith, was actually the son-in-law of Bailey Smith. So you have three people that served as president of the Southern Baptist Convention in the first, 15, 20 years or something like that, of that's one-third of the presidents of the Southern Baptist Convention in that time that came out of a single church in Oklahoma. Then also you had Adrian Rogers, who was the first one. He was elected to serve three terms, the only one that's ever been served three terms that I know of, and the Southern Baptist as president. He was elected 1 year, and then they elected Then he didn't run, and then they elected Bailey Smith, and later when they needed him, they brought him back and elected him for two more terms. The first 10 years were crucial because at the point in 10 years, if you elect the president and he appoints only his friends and cronies to office, in 10 years, literally every single position in the Southern Baptist Convention is their person. And then they fired leaders, put their own people in, and that's who's running the convention today.
Well, that's so taking it over, what are you doing to take it back? I mean, you must have a plan.
There's no plan to take it back. And the reason why is because we would have to do exactly what they did. You'd have to take over, never appoint anyone from a different perspective. You'd have to be as totalitarian in your operation as they are, and we're not.
Well, and of course you wouldn't do that because it would be wrong.
Yeah. I mean, to say that because you got 51% of the vote, now 100%, you know, this convention is going to follow your will and whims, that's basically what you see happening in the administration today. You know, he didn't even have a majority vote. He lost both elections, but they still acted and operated as though, you know, they had a plurality and had some mandate to do all the things that they have done.
You don't have dipole voting machines, do you?
No, we don't have dipole voting machines in Oklahoma. It's astonishing how much better the voting machines are in Oklahoma than they are in Florida and some other places.
Mm-hmm.
But now, what moderate and mainstream Baptists like myself have done, most of them have left the Southern Baptist Convention, did that back in the 1990s. The reason they left was because they defunded the Baptist Joint Committee on Religious Liberty. The Baptist Joint Committee on Religious Liberty has been there for 70 years with one mandate, and that is to be a watchdog agency that protects the First Amendment, separation of church and state.
Mike, and they oh my gosh.
They defunded that organization.
Did it get any publicity when they did that?
Sure. Every other Baptist denomination in the United States is still supporting the Baptist Joint Committee on Religious Liberty. Only the Southern Baptist Convention left, and they started their own, which now Richard Land is the head of. Richard Land is the head of Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention. Now, we started an organization that was called the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
The Cooperative Baptist Fellowship is now operating as a moderate convention. It runs out of Atlanta, Georgia. Most of people say, you know, well, to identify it, you know, in a public eye, it's like we're Jimmy Carter Baptist. Jimmy Carter is part of the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, one of the key leaders that's there.
Hmm.
And there's a new movement that is taking place, and maybe some of your listeners, if they're Baptists, they need to put this on their calendar, because January 30th through February 1st, 2008, in Atlanta, there will be a celebration for a new Baptist covenant, which will bring all the Baptist denominations in North America, that counts Canada and Mexico, together.
Mm-hmm.
Except for the Southern Baptists. They're invited, but Southern Baptist Convention doesn't want anything to do with us. Coming together, and there's going to be a new movement of Baptists that are not going to be dominated by these fundamentalist right-wing people that are moving the entire, you know, claim to speak for all the Baptists in America, 16 million of them, whenever they get up on political kinds of issues.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what, you know, Baptists were supposed to be doing. There was a meeting in January with Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter together announcing that we're going to have this meeting in January of 2008. And what you'll see there is that people are just tired of having Baptists be cheerleaders for war, and Baptists be cheerleaders for terrorism, not terrorism, but for torture. I mean, who is it that defends this administration on all that stuff? It's the Baptists, Richard Land.
They do, and of course they put them into place to do that so that they can have some sort of a semblance of support in the religious community.
Now, this community of Baptists.
What happens when you confront them? Or do you
When you confront
Southern Baptists who are members of this about what they're doing and how different that is than the charge of Jesus, that what we're supposed to do.
Well, if you're in Oklahoma, it's more like they confront me. But it's, you know, I don't have much of an opportunity to speak anymore. When I first went to the Baptist Convention in Oklahoma, I could pass, try to offer resolutions, but they found parliamentary ways to move that out, and now there's no way to do it at all. Everything has to go through a committee, and they'll never let anything come through the floor. But most of the time, what you'll see is, Baptists are generally very conservative people,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of times they're that will fit well with the more conservative kind of political positions. But they're also fair-minded people, and they want their leaders to speak the truth, and they don't want.
Very upsetting when they find that they have been lied to.
Yeah, when they've been betrayed, when their trust has been betrayed, well, they'll wake up. And, that doesn't mean that all of a sudden now you're going to see progressive thought coming out of Baptists and they're going to become liberals. Baptists have never been liberals. The only thing that we've ever been liberal on, we were radical. We came out of the radical Reformation because we thought that everybody should be able to worship according to the dictates of their own conscience. No one should be forced to worship with other, worship in a way that they didn't feel comfortable with. They shouldn't be forced, by public officials into some kind of worship service. Or things like that. That was the issue that we were the most firm and resolute on. That's not the position we have in Southern Baptist life anymore, but we do in all the other Baptists across the country. So, you're not going to see Baptists get out on the front end of a lot of progressive issues, but that one issue, you're going to see them stand firm for where they've been historically.
Well, and that's, of course, huge.
Well,
because that makes a tremendous difference.
Well, yeah, it would if they would just stop trying to figure out how to establish Christian faith and force everybody into a second-class status in their own country.
Well, of course, that's what they want because of the political power it gives them. It has nothing to do with religion.
Well, the way they don't call it political power, what they say, it's a culture war. So they want Christianity to be dominant in the cultural sphere. But if you just think a minute about Baptist theology, Baptists are born-again believers. That means that they have a personal and an individual kind of religious experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that's handed down. It's not something they receive from their culture. So how does a culture become Christian? It can't be born again like an individual person can. The whole theology for Baptists is completely betrayed by this. But, if you look, there was a PBS series about 10 years ago that was done called With God on Our Side. It was based on a book by William Martin, who's a professor at Rice University. And in that first episode of that series, they had a film crew that talked with Jerry Falwell. And they asked Falwell about that. They said, I thought Baptists were the people that were trying to find a way to change society by conversion. You convert people one by one to do that. And Falwell said on that interview, says, well, that's a correct premise. In reality, it doesn't work out that way. In reality, for Jerry Falwell, and he's the leader of the Moral Majority, which was the initial organization to do that, in his mind, the way that you do it is you get them saved, you get them born again, you get them baptized, and then you get them registered to vote.
Oh, my God. That's pretty scary. I can see you're doing a tremendous amount of work, and it's very exciting work that needs to be done. Thank you so much for being with us today on Thomas Jefferson's birthday. I thought that was a really nice timing.
Well, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
You take care, and God bless.
You too.
Thanks. Bye. And that's our show for today, April 13th. 2007. Here at The Spiritual Politician, we're working to help individuals find the ideas that make all human organizing tools like government non-impactive to us as a people and to the world. Freedom is doing the right thing, and that really does matter to all of us, doesn't it? So here's something that the birthday boy wrote. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that when any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute not new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. And when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Thank you, Thomas Jefferson. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that eventually brings us to freedom. And may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.